This is 515. I'm Larry Ryan. I am pleased to have you as a listener to 515, the Ultraman podcast, and I appreciate every time you recommend this podcast to one of your friends. As I get ready to move into the second full year of bringing you the stories of the Ultra family, I ask that you please share your enjoyment of listening to the podcast to those who haven't heard yet. It would be great to at least double the audience again this coming year. So please tell two friends to listen. If you've heard something that you know they will appreciate, why not share with them the direct link to that episode? Thanks again for listening. Here is today's show.
You're listening to 515, the Ultraman podcast, the show that invites you into the lives of people who make up the Ultra family. Here's your host for these conversations, Larry Ryan.
Thank you, MJ. Well, we have another Steve King story coming up in this episode, and I had such a great conversation with my guest today that he will be the only guest in today's episode. He's the 2015 world champion. So let's get to it. My Ohana guest today is a three-time Ultraman finisher. He climbed the podium from third in Canada to second in Hawaii to becoming the Hawaii champion in 2015 when he set a day two record time of 7 hours, 10 minutes, and 6 seconds. Like my Ohana guest in the previous episode, he has also studied physics, but now makes his living full-time in triathlon as the owner and head coach of Discomfort Zone Performance Coaching. He joins me from the hometown of John McRae. For Canadian listeners, you will recognize that name as the author of In Flanders Fields. That city is Guelph, Ontario. And my guest today is Mike Coughlin. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Thanks. Thanks for that, Larry. And actually, I love the John McRae reference. Our 5-year-old is actually at John McRae School. And, you know, it's only a kilometer from where we live. And that's right near the John McRae House. So, you know, which is a monument to John McRae. And so we go by there all the time.
Yeah. It seemed like a good reference to pull out for Guelph. Yeah. It's either that or the Griffins.
Yeah.
So Mike, I would like to, maybe go through your athletic career a little bit, kind of in order and touch on some of the unique events that you've done, and maybe some of the stuff that you've learned along the way that helped get you to the top of the world championship podium, if that sounds good.
Yeah, sure. Thinking about this, it's amazing to think that I did my first triathlon, 20 years ago now, in 2001. If you had told me then that this would have been, you know, 20 years later that I would have done all this crazy stuff, I would have, you know, called you mad, because I never saw it coming. But it's been a wild ride and, you know, some of the best memories of my life have come through this journey. In terms of longer distance races, my first Ironman, was in my third season of triathlon in 2003. And was inspired in part by recognizing that Ironman Canada in Penticton was being held on my 30th birthday. So I thought that would be kind of a cool birthday gift to give to myself. And, it turned out to be formative because it was really the event that took triathlon for me from one of many passing hobbies to something that I felt changed me internally. And I felt quite, you know, that there was this personal growth that was happening in the journey to achieving that goal. And so the ball really got rolling from there. Here we are.
Yeah, it's been quite the roll, as we'll go through here. I know that one of your first tries was in 2002 when you did Escape from Alcatraz, and you get to meet someone pretty special there. Can you tell me about that experience for you?
Yeah, that was just one of those great pieces of luck. I was on the bike course after surviving the swim in from in from Alcatraz Island. And, you know, it was one of my first triathlons, really. It was my second season in the sport. It was over my head. And I was just kind of soaking it all up. And I'm riding along and I look over at this guy beside me. And he, I think he actually said something to me, "Oh, you're riding strong." And, you know, so we're chatting as we're going up a hill. And I look over and I do a double take because I realize this guy's only got one arm and his other arm is a stump that is plugged into this, you know, thing on his handlebar that he had rigged. And at the time I just thought he was some awesome athlete that was overcoming this challenge. And later I realized that it was Willie Stewart, who is a Paralympian and, you know, one of the most famous challenged athletes, in North America anyway, if not the world. And, we actually rode back and forth the whole bike ride together. And then as soon as I got to the run, he, you know, gave me some kind words and then just like took off through transition and dropped me like a bad habit. It was hilarious. And I was like, oh boy, this is amazing. The people that do this stuff are just amazing.
Yeah. And this is, as you said, like one of your first triathlons. So to have somebody like that in the field and to inspire you, I'm guessing that helped you throughout your career to keep the inspiration going.
Oh, for sure. You know, I think, you know, I think that's one of the greatest things about our sport and, you know, about big endurance challenges is that the people that you meet, like there's no shortage of inspiration. And, you know, so I keep running into that and I tell my athletes that I coach, you know, to look for inspiration in each other and in unlikely places because you never know what's around the corner.
Now, in 2002, you also took part in what sounds like a uniquely Canadian triathlon. It was also, I guess it's actually a quadrathlon. Can you tell me about that race and why it was important to developing you as an athlete?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that question. So the race you're referring to is known as the Beaton Classic. And it's named after Bill Beaton, who was the mayor of Sudbury, where I took up triathlon, where I was living at the time. And it really captured the geography of the Northern Ontario region, you know, and included what was a big part of Bill Beaton's athletic career and many others in that area, which was paddling. So we're talking about canoeing. And so the race was swim, bike, canoe, run. And so you talk about transitions, you had to transition from cycling to sitting in a canoe paddling and then get out of that and run. And so not only that, but you had to, it was, you know, the conditions really would dictate how well you did because a windy day on the lake made a huge difference, you know, compared to, I'd say more so than say on the bike, and skill level. You know, a lot of triathletes, people that were training for triathlon would come take on this challenge and myself included. And the canoe was you could really see who knew what they were doing in the canoe. Yeah. Yeah. So in general training in Sudbury, you know, I lived there, up until, 2011. So that included my training for my first and part of the training for my second, Ultraman, you know, that rugged environment and the people that it bred in terms of endurance athletes who are all very supportive of each other. That community really, really formed who I was as an endurance athlete. And I'd say that, you know, the Beaton Classic definitely captures everything about that. So, yeah.
Yeah, that definitely sounds unique for sure. So then in 2005, only a few short years later, you find your way over to Hawaii as a crew member for Ultraman. How does that come about?
Yeah, the way I stumbled onto a crew for Ultraman was part of a bit of a bigger adventure that started with being accepted into a training camp in New Zealand in January of 2006. And so it was 2005 at the time, and those of us that have been around long enough and doing Ironman and whatnot might remember Gordo Byrne, who, you know, had his own website and was really an early, early blogger before it was even called that at the time, and really shared a lot of information about his journey in triathlon and helped prop people up quite a bit, in addition to, you know, really going for his own, pushing his own limits. Also an Ultraman champion, by the way, world champion in 2002, I believe. And Scott Molina, who I think needs no introduction as a legend in our sport. They put on Epic Camp, what they called it, and they had been doing this for a few years. And I was a ravenous reader of all the Epic Camp blogs, sitting in, you know, my office in Sudbury between training sessions, consuming all the stories and dreaming of one day doing it. And they put out applications for the Epic Camp 2006 in New Zealand, and I applied, you know, on a hope and a prayer, and got accepted, and realized I was in for a bit of a challenge. I was in way over my head, really. So I began this process of planning to be there early. And then, well, if I'm going to do that anyway, I'll do this. And it turned into a leave of absence I took from my job for about 5 months to spend the winter in New Zealand and stop in Hawaii along the way. So the connection to the Hawaii part was that I realized that my trip timing kind of fit really nicely with Ultraman, which in my mind was only some obscure thing that was supposed to be the heart and soul of triathlon. People would talk about it in hushed tones, or I'd read about these stories and it wasn't all that well known. And I was like, I've got to find out more about this. So I booked a layover for a week over the course of the race, with no idea how one involves themselves with this. I don't think you spectate, you know, in a traditional sense at Ultraman. So I just emailed Jane Bacchus, who, you know, was in charge at the time, and she was great. Got back to me and said, "Okay, I'll keep an eye out for crew. We always need crews for people." I said, "Oh, great! I'd love to be more involved." And you know, and as it happened, I did get on a crew. It was a gentleman who had actually done Epic Camp the year before, and his name was Michael Hanrek, and he was from England. And he only had one person on his crew. It was his girlfriend. And they needed a driver. So I found myself driving the van around the island. And talk about a great way to learn about Ultraman up close. It was just amazing. It all really started there. That was where I, that's where the seed was planted.
And that's all it takes to hook you in, and then you're coming back time after time. So in your travels down to Middle Earth, tell me a little bit about what you did down at this camp. What sort of, because I understand you get into some pretty big blocks of training there and things like that. What happens at the camp? How does it affect what you've been doing, and when you leave, how it changes for you?
Yeah. So I've done triathlon for 20 years now, and 21, I guess. And Epic Camp is still the single biggest week of training that I've ever done. It will probably be the single biggest week of training that I will ever do. I think I would have added 30 minutes of training to the first week at some point, because then I could say I did 50 hours in the first week. It was 49 and a half if I'm splitting hairs, but it was really that big. It was absurd, actually. And it was like a buffet. They were really good about giving you incentives and giving you room, enough rope to hang yourself, basically. and I did exactly that. But I'd probably do it the same way again if I were to go, you know, back at the time. And it was amazing. So it was a tour of the South Island of New Zealand. So you actually each day stayed in a different place, and your gear was brought with you. So it was like a touring camp, if you will. Nice. But set up with access to pools in the towns that had them along the way, and running routes and little challenges and points competitions and all the things that just, you know, suckered me into swinging, you know, for the fences and putting myself in a pretty big training overreaching hole. It was phenomenal. And I have to say, it also put me, just after, you know, mere weeks after crewing at Ultraman, I found myself surrounded by three Ultraman world champions. Gorda Byrne, as I mentioned, Scott Molina, who people will remember for winning the 1988 Kona Ironman, right? Ironman World Championship. But he also won Ultraman Worlds as well earlier than that. And I'm the year escapes me. Steve King will let you know. That'd be somewhere in the mid 80s. And Jonas Kolting, who is, you know, another Ultraman legend, multi-winner and great guy. And so I found myself, you know, training with all three of these guys. So that was, you know, that was pretty, you know, that was inspiring as well.
And that can only whet your appetite more for wanting to get back to that island and actually race it yourself.
Yeah. It's funny. I, at the time, was very much on my so-called Ironman journey. You know, that I did that first Ironman on my 30th birthday. And then, you know, the Kona qualification, siren song was calling and was just that barely bit out of reach that makes it so compelling. And so I found myself chasing that. And that was part of the, where I was at the time. So Ultraman, while being inspired and surrounded by people that were involved, still seemed like it was something that mentally I couldn't wrap my head around yet. Right. So this is 2006. And I, later that year, I actually qualified for Kona. But it wasn't still for another couple of years before I could even imagine training for Ultraman. I think I had really, it had really, been clear that it was a big challenge and that I wanted to give it my full effort. So it still took a few years, even just to get ready to start that training journey.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess that camp, though, it did kind of propel you into that next level with your Ironmans, because it was after that you, as you said, you qualified for Kona. And then in 2008, I saw on your stats, you got your personal best of 9:21:09 at Beach to Battleship, which I guess, is that the race that later became the Ironman North Carolina?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
So that's right.
What was it about that course or your ability on that day that you were able to pull off a PB, and what's the beach and what's the battleship?
So it was a really cool race. It was put on by Setup Events, I think they're called, and they're a pretty big regional, race directorship. And they set up a course that started on, in Wilmington, North Carolina. So on, the beach, and you swam in the intercoastal waterway. So it was ocean water, but it was kind of, protected. And it was also with a incoming tide. So I got to put a little asterisk beside that. And that probably bought me 10 minutes that tide pushing me in, on the swim part. But you did the bike course and the run course in and around Wilmington. And then the finish line was actually at the Battleship North Carolina, which is like a monument. It's an actual battleship. That's there. And it was a group trip, with some athletes that I was coaching and some friends. It wasn't necessarily a big deal race that I had been gunning for, but having done maybe 5 Ironmans prior to that, they were always successful and good, and maybe listeners can understand what I'm talking about when it's like, I never really quite nailed one, never quite had, you know, always left feeling that was good, but I had a little bit more in me. And, I think it was by then I had come to understand my body and my training well enough that I knew exactly the level of fitness I was at. And I knew how to execute exactly to that level of fitness. And so it was not just the fastest Ironman, but I wasn't actually in the best shape. I just knew exactly what shape I was in, and it was the best execution. So I remember at the finish line, I thought to myself, well, if I never do another Ironman again, it doesn't matter, because I nailed it, so to speak. Right. And so that was a level of satisfaction, but it was also this door that was opening. I think in particular, for the double marathon at Ultraman, I think there was some fear that I had with that. The idea that I hadn't properly been able to execute an Ironman run held me back from wanting to train for an Ultraman properly. And once that happened, it's like, okay, now I can see myself trying to go and doing the Ultraman.
Yeah. I was looking at your times for that race. Your run was amazing. It was a 3:21:47. Your swim, as you said, I guess ate it coming in, was a 50:39. And your bike was 5:01:59. So 1:59 over 5 hours. Were you aware of that 5 hour mark when you were on the bike?
I actually wasn't. It's actually an interesting story because the mile markers on the course were off. And I had a power meter and I was riding to power. So I wasn't actually looking at distance at all. Mm-hmm. I was looking at time. For my nutrition, and I was riding along, and I figured I was in for a 5:25, 5:20 based on the mile markers. And all of a sudden, it jumped from, you know, in 90 miles to like 110 in or something like that. And I found myself, oh my God, I'm really close to the finish. And then I rolled in. And I think had I known, it would have been too tempting to go for that, you know, at the time. Breaking 5 hours on the bike was a big deal, and mm-hmm. I had certainly never done it. And so I think I might have got suckered into going off my plan. So in a way, it was a gift to have the mile markers off. So it kept me just focused on what I could control and set up that run, which for me, that, you know, as more of a biker than a runner, being able to unlock that run, as I said, that was the real victory.
Yeah. And I noticed that you had a T1 time of 5:11.
Yeah, at that race. That actually was another part of my success. It was 4 degrees Celsius in T1. It was the coldest. So it was November 1st, but obviously North Carolina's, that's unseasonably cold. I think they said it was their coldest Halloween in some number of decades. So it was none of the locals were prepped for what it would be like. And thankfully I brought all sorts of gear just in case. And so I took my time. That's right. I took my time, put on all the right things, to make sure that I didn't have to ride above my level to warm up, or to digest nutrition. And so having both of those things in hand, because I took my time in T1 again, set me up. So it was the things that were not as fast as I usually like them to be that actually set up the best run. So,
mm-hmm. And I think that's probably what helps a lot of the Ultraman people too, is learning your body, learning those things where you can figure out that it might not look like it on day one that I'm doing the best thing or the fastest thing, but on day three, that's going to pay off for me. And you've obviously developed some of that knowledge through these Ironman races and were able to put it all together, as you said.
Yeah. And even within a day, right. Mm-hmm. You know, although I'll admit that, you know, you mentioned that transition time, I'm quite proud of executing the patience, because I'm a bit of a transition racer. I like to sort of rock through transition. And, you know, I've got more than one story of that coming back to bite me. It's, you know, time and time again, it's shown that, you know, it's certain, as long as you make the right choices, it's not about how fast you go or how slow you go. It's about making the right choices at the right times. Mm-hmm. You know, in Ultraman, definitely making sure that you eat in the swim. I mean, and in Hawaii, make sure that you wash your mouth out with water so that the salt doesn't upset your stomach, because it just, that'll throw off day one at the very least, if not the whole weekend for you. So, you know, those little things, even if it takes a little bit longer, are critical.
Yeah. And I think those are those little things that the listener wants to learn too. So it's great having someone as experienced as you sharing these things with them. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, at that point, you're obviously in very good shape and you're jumping around a little bit in the distances that you're doing and putting on some air miles coming out here to British Columbia. So in 2008, you come out for the ITU World Sprint, where you got a fourth in your age group. 2009, you come back to Kelowna this time, where you were second in your age group in an Olympic with another PB of 2 hours. 1 minute and 59 seconds. So that 1:59 again.
There you go.
Were you aware of that one?
Yeah, but in that case, it was just, I was at my limit. That was all I had. And, yeah. And you know, it's, that's one day, maybe
I can make a comeback and go for the transition for that one.
Yeah, that's right. But, yeah, that was a good one.
Yeah. And then obviously it comes to 2010 and you come to Ultraman Canada, which is where you and I first crossed paths. I was there crewing for Lucy, of course. And at that race, although your first Ultraman, you came third place. And again, to a couple of great champions, Kevin Kutchar and Mike LaRue. What was it like for you racing against those guys and coming in third?
Yeah, it was, that was fantastic. I mean, I have to admit that, when I first found out that Ultraman Canada was something I needed to do in order to apply to do Ultraman in Hawaii, I was surprised and, a bit put off, because I think when I had decided I'm ready to train for this double marathon, I'm going to go straight to Hawaii and do it. And when I crewed in 2005, that's how you did it. There was no requirement that you do another Ultraman. And so this was one of these things where the unexpected became a great opportunity for a wonderful experience and a wonderful, chance to meet people and enjoy something as fantastic as Ultraman Canada, which I may not have otherwise done. And so, yeah, there was a little bit, it was almost like I had a bit of entitlement. I crewed at, Ultraman in 2005. I know everybody. I know the Ohana. I'll just send them an email and say, hey guys, I'm ready to go. And then I got this, well, actually we're filling up and therefore, we're instituting a qualifying process, not qualifying, but validating, I guess, process. And so I found myself, what do you mean I have to do another Ultraman? I think I had it in my head that I was going to just show up at Hawaii and do it once and have this great experience and then sail off into the sunset or something. But it ended up being, first of all, it knocked me off my high horse, which was obviously needed at the time. But also it was the richest experience to do Ultraman Canada and, to meet everybody there. And as you said, Kevin and Mike were racing and, Mike won Worlds later that year. Kevin had already won Worlds years before and set, a great course record at the time, schooling all of us. Again, inspiration in spades, so many great memories from that race, so many, great memories from training for that race. Another opportunity to, as you said, fly to BC. I definitely have done some of my most enjoyable racing in BC, have lots of friends there and really like the Okanagan. So it was great all around.
And what sort of things did you do to train for that? You were working with your coach at the time, I assume, that you had a coach at that time. And like, what were you doing to come up with a nutrition plan that would take you through 3 days rather than the one? And how were you developing your bigger training loads and keeping an eye on trying to avoid injuries, obviously, with ramping that stuff up? What was the plan that you guys came up with? And who was your coach during that time?
Yeah, so that actually was the first season that I worked with Alan Cousins, who is the coach that I've used for all of my Ultraman racing. Alan, funny enough, I met as a fellow athlete at Epic Camp in New Zealand. So everything seemed to happen on this trip that I took, down to New Zealand way back when. And at the time, Alan was working in a gym environment. I don't think he was a full-time coach the way he is now. And he then, over the few years after, we stayed in touch for a few years. And then one time I sent him an email. I said, I think, if you have room for me, I'd love you to take me on. And I've got this plan, this multi-year plan to take on the Ultraman and see what I could do. And he did. And I was super jazzed. And I think I kind of committed almost too much to the coaching process. I wanted to do right by him in the process so much that I sort of forced myself into some funny injuries, like in the opening weeks of training that were, I think more mental, emotional than physical, even though they manifested physically. And so what that did for us as coach athlete was it immediately created a point of tension and difficulty that we used to build what turned out to be a fantastic trust relationship. That is the core of any good coach athlete relationship. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it became a question of me trying to fit the training in exactly like he said it. And it was rubbing my life, you know, the way that I lived the wrong way. And we just had a few frank conversations about, it doesn't really matter that much that the load is distributed this way, as long as we hit these key goals. Mm-hmm. And we just rearranged it and everything just flowed from there. I did some really tough training because the timeline was a bit tight for getting ready. You know, I arrived on site with a great mindset. We set up a negative split strategy for all 3 days, which is actually quite good for the Ultraman Canada course in particular, which tends to be back heavy. Mm-hmm. It also took a bit of the pressure off. Actually having Kevin and Mike so far ahead was another aspect that took pressure off in my first Ultraman. If I was near the very front, it may have distracted me. So that was actually quite nice to have that set up and execute that negative split for power on day one and day two. And then on the run as well, I negative split the double marathon. So yeah. It was really positive.
That would be incredibly hard to do, especially as you said, you're a racer. You want to get out there and go. But as you said previously, you learned in those Ironman races that sometimes you can just do something early on that's going to be better further down the line. But to be able to actually pull it off and not get caught up in the moment and just go all out when you hit that flat section, you know, going down to Osuyus, and it's like, That's impressive that you're able to pull that strategy off.
Yeah, I guess that there was a process there where I retained some of that competitive, fast twitch, have fun for short periods of time through transition or something. But I really became a student of the negative split, and it actually took it arguably too far. And it became something I wanted to protect at all costs. So it was really helpful for my training development. And I think it's really important to build the ability to negative split. But eventually I had to outgrow that. So that comes later in the story, but Ultraman Canada was definitely the best example of crushing negative splits and the feeling of finishing strong is so positive that it gives you that want to come back, you know, right. As opposed to feeling crushed by the distance. So I think that was important to start off. Mm-hmm.
And after you finished Ultraman Canada, you went ahead and put in that application for the Worlds and were accepted. So in 2011, you went off to Tucson for the summer in order to train for the World Championships. Can you tell me why you chose to go there, what you were doing? And I understood you kind of like took a little retreat into a mountain cabin or something. So what was the plan of going off there?
Yeah. So the 2011 Ultraman Worlds was about as all in as I've ever done anything in my life of anything. And it was something that coincided with a shift in my career. I had made a decision shortly after Ultraman Canada that the coaching that I had been doing on the side, apart from my regular day job working in medical physics in a cancer treatment facility, that the coaching had taken up more and more of my time and my heart, my energy and my love, my passion. And so I realized that I really wanted to find out whether that was something that I could do full time. And so the way that I arranged that was I set up a 1 year leave of absence from my job. The first half of which was going to be all in for Ultraman. And the second half was going to be seeing if I could, make a go of full-time coaching, while still having the safety net of being able to go back to my career or my job that I had. And it also involved moving from Sudbury to Guelph, which I felt was, much better situated as a as a place to coach and to learn from other coaches, because it wasn't my, my, you know, what I trained in. So I wanted to, you know, cut my teeth with career coaches and be in that environment. So I packed up the house in Sudbury, put everything into a storage unit in Guelph, except for all my triathlon gear, which I shoved into the back of my Subaru. And I hopped in the car in July and drove to Boulder. Actually, I spent the summer in Boulder, Colorado. Alan actually lives in and around Boulder, so I had a chance to be closer to the coach. We did another camp with Alan and Gordo in the high mountains there, followed by very specific training until weather sort of started to turn, which is typically in September and into October. So at the beginning of October, when the weather turned and I still needed to put a good month in, my eyes pointed south to Tucson, and I drove down there, packed up all my gear again, and went to Tucson. And Tucson obviously is very popular with triathletes, usually for spring camps, winter camps, things like that. And Mount Lemmon is well known as an iconic climb that people do when they go down to train in Tucson. But what surprised me was I had never actually at the time heard of anybody, you know, living on the top of the mountain, which has a little village for, you know, people from Tucson to get away from the heat and vacation rentals. And I said, well, it seems to me that live high, train low is what you're supposed to do. So, you know, in consultation with Alan, we, you know, the goal of Boulder was to figure out how I handled altitude. Mm-hmm. And then from there to go down and live at the top of the mountain. So I rented a cabin. I did the whole hermit thing. And it was a month that I was there, and it was to finish off my training for Ultraman, and it was glorious. It was such a cool experience. Such a beautiful place to train. I got to know that mountain incredibly well. I did a marathon up the mountain. They had the Mount Lemmon marathon while I was there, which was great luck for me. You know, by the time it was time to go to Hawaii, I felt like I had basically turned over every stone I could, and it was time to race.
But of course, you actually become one of those triathlete cliches, just before going to the Ultraman World Championships. And, I'll pause here for a second for the listener to fill in the blank as to what that might be.
Now here's another Steve King story.
Hi everyone, I'm Steve King. The next person and athlete that I'm going to refer to is a lady who did her very first Ultraman right here in Penticton at Ultraman Canada in 1995. Recorded a time of 29:36.54 and won the event. She then went on to Hawaii for her first time at the Ultraman World Championships, also that same year, 1995, at just 25 years of age as well, and won the women's division there. That, in fact, was the same year that another Canadian come Australian who actually lives here in Penticton by the name of Kevin Cutjar also won the race. And remember, later on, 15 years later, he won Ultraman Canada and set a new course record at that time. Now, this lady went back to the Big Island in 1997, won for a second time, and then went back again a following year in 1998 and won again, but by a mere 45 seconds over Cecilia Ramos. She also returned once again to Ultraman Canada in 1999 to claim her fifth overall victory amongst the women, and she went 5 minutes and 10 seconds faster than she previously had. And it was fourth overall as well that year. But in fact, her fastest time came when she came second, and that was in 2007 when she returned and came seventh overall, but second female with a fastest time of 29:31.44. And this lady was truly, therefore, when you think about this, after 99, she was fourth overall, seventh overall, second female, but five victories, three at the World Championships, at two in her home country of Canada. She truly is the Canadian pioneer of ultra triathlon, a three-time world champion. And I'm referring, of course, to Tracy Preston.
Thank you, Steve, for that story about Tracy. Soon, Steve will be posting all of his Steve King stories as videos on his own website. That's at steve-king.ca. I recommend that you go and check it out. It covers a wide variety of his professional life as a clinical counselor, and it also covers his passion for sport. That's steve-king.ca. You can find a link in my show notes. You ended up having a bit of an accident. What happened to you?
Yeah. So hopefully I've set the stage as to how far, how much I had invested in this one particular race. And I had figured if I was going to go start a new career, I might not have time to really train well ever again. So this was going to be the, you know, race to end all races for me. So I had taken this time off. I had done all this training. I had gone to Hawaii and I was about 2 weeks out from the race, and I was in Hawaii and I was training on the course, on the day one course, which at the time went straight up from Keoho onto the upper highway and then across to Captain Cook instead of the new highway that I know is now there. And right at that intersection, actually, where the new one meets the old one, I was riding along and this car was waiting to turn out onto the road across my path and didn't see me. And right at that point of no return where you won't be able to hit the brakes in time, he pulled out and I went clear into the side of him at 50K an hour, smashed his windshield, flipped over somehow. I don't know what kind of somersault I did, but I landed on the pavement hard and didn't get up. And so it was a pretty devastating experience. But miraculously, I didn't break any bones. I remember wiggling my toes as I was laying there saying, please let, you know, all the nerves be good. And so, yeah, no spinal, no bone breaking. And so I just had two massive, massive bruises on my quads where my legs hit the aero bar pads as, you know, I went into the bike. The part of the bike was in front of me. It took all the impact. I say, you know, I like to say I wasn't training for Ultraman. I was actually training for the accident, because I'm pretty sure that had I not been in the shape of my life, it would have been a different outcome from that one.
And did the bike survive the accident?
Everything in front of me needed replacement. The fork, the wheel, the handlebars. But the frame itself and the group and everything was just fine. And Bike Works in Kona took fantastic care of me, and I didn't at least have to worry about that part of it. I had 13 days. It was 13 days before the swim start when that happened. And that was the toughest 13 days of training I've ever done, even though I didn't really do anything that you'd generally consider to be training. Mm-hmm. It was recovery training, I still get goosebumps actually just thinking back about it, because it was both incredibly hard, physically, mentally, emotionally, and incredibly humbling. And you know, both to feel like I was a little bit helpless, but also the outpouring of support that I got from the Ohana, from the organizers, from the other athletes that were already there on the island, people I didn't really know. Mm-hmm. And then just like, without even thinking twice, they were offering assistance. They were, you know, checking up on me. You could just feel the love. It was just, you know, I think I had styled myself a little bit of a lone wolf in those days, you know, tough and able to handle anything. And I'll just, you know, quietly prepare at the top of the mountain and then come in. And that just knocked me for a loop, and I learned a lot. That was, you know, that was probably the biggest lesson learning experience of my whole tri life. Still I think 2011 and at Ultraman was, you know, I don't think it'll ever be equaled for, you know, what that was like.
Mm-hmm. And so the Ohana that they gather around you, they prop you up. And it's not something that you were necessarily expecting. How does that help you actually then get through the race? Because you still go on and do the race and you do quite well. How do you think the Ohana experience is what maybe was a contributing factor to your second place finish there?
Let's see if I can put this in words. You feel like there's just something greater than yourself, that you're no longer this person in this race. You're in this bubble of beauty, just kind of, you know, adventuring around, not aimlessly, of course. You're still, you know, being able to push yourself to your limits and push others the same way. But you just feel that you just know that everybody wants the best out of everybody else. And you know, I've been to a lot of different races. That's not always true. That's not always the energy that you can feel, right? But there, it is absolutely the energy you can feel. And I just knew that in my cells. And it was, you know, it also just the humility, that's the only word I can come up with right now. You just feel like you're free to just express yourself the best way you can, you know, and as a result of that. And so that's, you know, that's always stayed with me.
Yeah. And it's more than, I guess, your crew that's uplifting you. It's this whole race at that point, because they all wanted you to succeed. I can only imagine what that was feeling like for you. I can understand why it would be difficult to maybe even put that into words.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm like, as I said, I'm getting some goosebumps going back, 10 years now, right? It's this weekend, or would be this weekend. And it was 10 years ago that happened. And it, you know, I can just put myself right back in those moments. You know, the uncertainty of not knowing if my legs were going to work, you know, when on the bike, and then I was pretty sure that this one was going to be okay. But you know, on those first pedal strokes up the hill on the bike, at, you know, race effort, and in particular, the double marathon run, I didn't run a step between the, you know, between the accident and the day three. Mm-hmm. And funny enough, I ran about 82 kilometers until it was 2K to go. And I could, my mind, you know, knew that I was going to finish. And then all the pain, the same type of pain that I felt when hit by that car, came right back into my legs. It's fascinating. Fascinating to see that, you know, that mind body connection to go 82 kilometers and then be okay. I'm going to make it. And then your legs just like being like, it's like people collapsing when they can see the finish line, right? As opposed to when they go across it. But
your mind just, it got to that point where it didn't have to hide that pain anymore for you. It was like, okay, we're going to make it. And then it just all rushes back.
Yeah, for sure.
And you were in the race as well. Tell me a little bit about that. Like, you finished second.
Tell me about the actual
racing part of it.
The racing was awesome. It was so exciting. So Alexander Ribeiro from Brazil, who is now the winningest, and I think at the time was the winningest Ultraman world champion of them all at 6 times total. He was there, and I managed to pass him on day one and finish ahead of him, but I was still a fair ways back of Jonas Colting, because yes, Jonas was there and is a front pack swimmer, of course, and really strong cyclist. So he was always going to be out front and for me to chase. And I managed to take some time back on him from day two, but not all of the time. And then unfortunately he developed an injury of some kind, and was unable to finish day three. But we were all tight by the end of day two. We were all within 10 or 15 minutes. And I think I was in the middle of that, ahead of Alex, but behind Jonas. And on day two in particular, Alex had, he took me aside after day one. It's like he puts his arm around me. It's like, you know, fantastic ride, blah, blah, blah. You know, make sure you kind of take it easy on day two at the beginning. It's a long day. And I was like, thanks, you know. And of course, at the time I was ready to negative split that ride, it's, you know, the first 40K are downhill. So it kind of naturally sets up for a negative split anyway, with lots of climbing towards the end. But then we get out, I don't know, about 40 minutes into the ride and he's gone. And he took a flyer. And I didn't worry about it. Bided my time. I had my plan. And sure enough, I reeled him in and we got to the gulches, and it's about 100 miles in. And that's still another, you know, 60, 70 miles, whatever, 80 miles to go and uphill. And so I'm like, okay, this is no problem. I'm gonna catch him eventually. I had some flat tires. I always had flat tires on day two in Hawaii. And eventually, though, I'm catching him. Everything's according to plan. And I'm sort of patting myself on the back. But what happens is I get a little bit complacent and he comes back on me and passes me again. And we get to the climb of the Kahalas, the Kahala Mountain Road, in the worst wind conditions I have ever experienced anywhere, anytime. And I can't speak for the entire history of the race, but judging from the people who got off their bikes and were walking their bikes, it, I think, was probably one of the worst years for the race as well. It was scary. It was, humbling, I guess. It was tough. The crosswinds on the climb coincided with Alex catching back up to me, and he just dropped me on this climb. This was the climb I had mentally prepared forever. This was where I was going to make my mark on the event, and this was going to be great. And I felt like I was going in reverse. At one point, I'm going up the climb and my crew member's running, jogging beside me, trying to say some positive words. And he had to slow to a walk to hand me my bottle because I was going so slow, you know, just trying to keep my bike from being tossed off the road. And of course, I did see the humor in that at the time, even though I was in, you know, not in a good way. Right. And at that moment, it was a switch that went off in my mind, and I tapped into my core motivator, which for me is joy. Mm. I don't race from anger. I can't race from anger. It just doesn't seem to work for me. But when I race from joy, it's like, you know, so I scream at him, this is awesome. This is why we're here. I love this stuff, you know, and I just dug in, and it wasn't pretty, but I can honestly say I gave 100% of my effort up that climb. And then I remembered, and I had one of the only bike rides I did on my injured legs, leading into that race, was the descent from that climb. I got a lift to the top and I rode the 13 miles down to the finish. Figured it was going to be easy on my legs, but I needed it for my nerve, right? Mm-hmm. Put me on the windiest, craziest spot on this course and let me get my nerve back for riding a bicycle. And so when I got there in the race, I had, I don't know, a minute or a minute and a half to, you know, that I had lost to Alex on the climb. And I just went in mission focus, put my head down, and it was arrow or die for me. And I just kind of, I don't know if I do it again, to be honest, but I dug in and you know, surfed the wind all the way down, and eventually caught him and passed him and put a minute into him by the end, just on the descent. Mm-hmm. And it was exhilarating. But what it taught me was that not only was I such a negative split sort of smart, quote unquote, racer, but I was also a chaser. I like to have somebody to chase. And as soon as I got to the front of the race, it was like I lost my, I didn't know how to lead. Mm. And so for me to learn that lesson, because we went back and forth and I could feel the energy change each time. And so that was something I took home with me. On day three, I still did have a lead, but if you know Alex and his running, it was a miracle. I was only 9 minutes behind him for the overall race by the end of it. I negative split the double marathon, again, wanting to protect my smart racing, and gave up the win in the process potentially just to avoid blowing up. But, I walked away from that realizing that I needed to not necessarily come back in better shape, but to, mentally train myself to be comfortable in a leading position. Mm-hmm. And that was the missing piece. And I had a front row seat to learning it. I mean, you know, to watch how he handled all the conditions and all that, you know, as somebody who was much more of a runner than a biker, he beat me on the bike. Even though he beat me on the run, he beat me on the bike, right? Yeah. With his choices and his, you know, the way he executed. So it was, yeah. And had I not been able to recover with everybody's help, I wouldn't have been able to learn those lessons in 2011. And so that, you know, all of those are the reasons that 2011 still has that so very special place in my heart.
Mm-hmm. And I think we see that a lot in all sports. Generally, you have to get to the big game and lose before you learn how to win it. You know?
Yeah. Right? Yeah. And I always thought it was cliche, you know, pay your dues, all this stuff. And now I understand. Like, you know, whatever it is, in my case, it was about leadership. You know, for somebody else, it might be overcoming certain fears or what have you. But it was, there is also an element to getting comfortable on the Big Island. The Hawaii event is very cognitively demanding. It takes a lot of your attention. You're dodging stuff that's, you know, debris from that's come out onto the road that can make you get a flat tire. You're dodging those little reflective dots, you know, that are on the road. There's traffic. It's, you know, open to traffic. Interestingly, I almost got hit again at the exact same spot in the race that I did before the race. And at that time I was not in the aero bars. I was sitting up waving to make sure that this guy saw me. And he did one of those things where he starts out and then stops and sees you. So in a way, I wonder whether, getting hit before allowed me to avoid getting hit in the race. A lot of those things become more familiar when you've been there before. Mm-hmm. So again, the role of experience, I thought, was a cliche, but I got a real appreciation for exactly how that works.
Mm, yeah. It was going to be a one and done. Obviously after that experience, you've probably changed your mind a little bit. And you focus a little bit on the cycling portion and doing some more long distance cycling events. As we said before, you were at the Beach to Battleship in the Carolinas. And in 2013, you went back to the Carolinas for another event called the Assault on the Carolinas as a cycling event. What is that event?
Well, that is something that takes place every year in a town called Brevard near Asheville. And it happens at the same time that I typically host a training camp, a triathlon training camp in Asheville. So the AOTC, as it's known, ends up being our final ride of the week at the end of camp. We do this Metric Century, it's this beautiful course that goes down into South Carolina and then back up into North Carolina, hence the name. And the sort of main feature of the event is the Caesar's Head climb, which is about 10K long and gets you back up into North Carolina.
And on that Caesar's Head climb, I understand that you found it a little too easy to do. So you decided to just throw away part of your bike and see what would happen.
So yeah, still the strangest thing that's ever happened and hardest thing that I've ever done on a bike has been to get up that hill, because about halfway, you know, some number of kilometers before the hill, I was riding in the lead bunch and I felt something strange around my pedals. And I looked down and there is my crank arm attached to my foot, but not attached to the bicycle. So I guess there is a bolt that came loose at some point and I didn't check it, and it was gone, the bolt that is. So I had to sort of, you know, unclip my pedal from my shoe by hand and stuff the crank arm and pedal into my back pocket. And I sort of sat there on the side of the road for a few minutes watching the race go away and other people kind of go on by. And then I said, well, I may as well just pedal along. Maybe I'll get to, you know, further along and further along to get a sag wagon or something. And so I just did a lot of single leg drilling along. And then as I got closer and closer to the big climb, it started to like seep into my head. I wonder, could I go all the way up that hill? Because I would go up these smaller hills and I'd make it. And I'd be like, okay. And so it became a mission. By the time I got to Caesar's Head, I'm like, I am going up this hill. And it was comically tough. there were a couple of times that I didn't quite make the pedal stroke and my pedal went backwards, and then I quickly adjusted to be able to keep the bike balanced. interesting, I cramped in the non-pedaling leg. It was sort of spastically, sort of going around making phantom pedal circles in thin air, because it didn't know what to do, and I guess that caused it to cramp. But indeed, I made it, and ironically, the race mechanic was at the top of the hill, obviously. So I was able to use both pedals for the remainder of the event, to just kind of cool down, I guess. But, that was the hardest thing I've ever done on a bike. Holy cow. But it made for a memorable day.
Yeah, that's a good story. I like that one. And we will be right back. Hey listener, I wanted to let you know, I have some exciting guests coming up in the next few months. The next episode will feature Jen McVeigh, race director of Ultraman Arizona. I will also be featuring some of the athletes who will be competing at the upcoming Ultraman races, Ultraman Florida and Ultraman Arizona. The next episode will be available December 31st. So a little something to listen to after your polar bear swim. And now back to my conversation with Mike. Also in 2013, you did the Furnace Creek 508 as a two-man team where you won. And then in 2014, you did Hoodoo 500 stage race where you were winning again. So you were obviously focusing on some of this longer distance racing as you're training at this time. Can you tell me a little bit about maybe something that was interesting out of those events, and how you changed your focus to that cycling during that part of your training?
Yeah, sure. So important for context is that I stayed true to my goal of finishing the 2011 Ultraman and going full bore into full-time coaching. I still had 6 months to figure out whether that was what I wanted to do with my life. And so I followed through on that commitment, and found my feet in Guelph, and started to coach and build, an athlete base. And for the next few years, once I decided, yes, indeed, this was, what I wanted to do, for my career, that was my focus. So I didn't have, the time and energy to devote to proper long distance triathlon training. So I think the first year I did a 50 mile run, which because it was on trails took me a lot longer than any of my Ultraman runs. And it was all, close to 10 hours or something under trained. And I learned lessons there too. But I think what I was doing was just keeping a hand in long, difficult challenges for the mental benefit or the mental growth, mm-hmm. Without having to commit too much time to training, because that wasn't where my priorities were. And a lot of times I was taking advantage of camps that I was putting on and trying to do a long event at the end of a camp. I know in Colorado, we did a camp in Boulder, and I did a 200 mile, 30,000 foot, of climbing ride with the Rocky Mountain Cycling Club. And I did it on 3 hours of sleep or less at the end of a very long camp that I was coaching, which put me in a great spot to, not necessarily do well, but learn and build. Because those guys at that event, in ultra running, it's really chill. Everybody likes to roll out easy and just let the day come, right? Mm-hmm. In some of these ultra bike events, they go right from the gun, 4 o'clock in the morning, middle of the dark, middle of the night, they don't care. First climb, the pace is on, and I don't know where I'm going and I can't see. And so I learned some of that more aggressive strategies while tired in a few of those experiences. But yeah, I saw an opportunity to sort of work on the mental side. You don't necessarily need to be at your best to build skills in isolation and then put them together later.
Mm-hmm. And you definitely probably can't be at your best if you want to work on the mental side.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. Or it helps not to, whether you're relatively fit, you can take a suicide pacing strategy and see what happens. I tried that as well in training, and it was helpful. I mean, it wasn't pleasant, but it was, It certainly was what I needed.
Mm-hmm. Well, finally in 2015, you put it all together, all these things you've been learning at the Ultraman World, and you become the world champion. Is there one thing that you learned along the way that you think is probably obviously a little bit of all of those things, but is there a piece of advice that you can give to the listener that wants to go out and take on the Ultraman World Championship? If there's one thing that you share with people to do, what would it be?
Well, I mean, specific to Ultraman, definitely respect the swim. It doesn't mean you need to be the fastest swimmer. But you know, it's certainly one of those, Ultraman is certainly one of those triathlons where you really can lose it in the swim. And I didn't have my best swim there in 2015, but I also made sure that I, you know, the problems I had were not deal breakers, for me. And that came from a lot of the prep. I was excited to swim really well there and it didn't pan out. But, again, like we talked about with transitions and stuff, sometimes the chip time doesn't tell the tale, right? Mm-hmm. The things that you do to be strong in one area for another, you know, are between the lines. So, being strong in the swim, really matters, to set up the whole weekend. And you know, you gotta, for me, it was all about studying the event, studying the courses, and becoming a student of the sport. So, you know, take it all in, and maybe you're not training for a big event in 1 year, but it doesn't mean you can't learn by applying yourself to different things. I'd say in general, aside from Ultraman specifically, mm-hmm. but certainly applicable, is to know thyself. You know, so many lessons I learned came from understanding who I was, and whether it was how I organized my training, you know, in some of the discussions I had with my coach around that, or recognizing that I was never going to win the Ultraman in the swim. So I needed to make sure I was the strongest at my strong event, which is the cycling, and, you know, do what was required for the other events to position myself. And, you know, and then in it, you know, so the flip side, the other edge of the sword of knowing thyself is to grow and seek growth. Mm-hmm. That's always been central to why I do this stuff. You know, it's about discovering, and I discover things about myself. As I said, you know, I wasn't comfortable in the lead. I needed to change that, or, you know, challenge myself in those areas to come back a different athlete. And often that happens well removed from the race preparation. Other years, you know, where I was able to put myself in position to, you know, make key adjustments to, you know, and to grow. So that was what I think in a nutshell mm-hmm. positioned me for it in 2015.
And now, how do you take that same philosophy to your work life as a coach now? Do you take that same philosophy of I need to learn as much as I can? I need to be a sponge and read everything and learn everything and then bring that to my athletes? Like, are you constantly growing now as a coach?
Well, absolutely. But again, I think actually that there are parallels there. I think you're going to have skills as a coach, natural talents, as personality traits. I do think that certainly for me, personality and fit really matters. Again, developing that trust and being, you know, having a set of your set of skills being complementary to what the athlete needs is really important. And filling in the gaps where you may, you know, say, oh, I've got to learn and know everything I can about swim technique, because I don't know enough about swim technique. You know, I was obsessed with finding, you know, all the little bits about swim technique when I was started as a full-time coach. Mm-hmm. And you get to a certain level and you realize, okay, if you're never going to be the best swim technique coach, you need to be good enough to take the athletes a certain distance and then have resources to help with making sure that they aren't limited by that. And build a team around you much like a, you know, an Ultraman athlete builds a, you know, their support crew around them, is to, you know, build a team of other experts. You know, we're really lucky here in Guelph. It was something that I had hoped was true when I talked to a few of the coaches in advance of moving here. And turned out to be true that we have a very collaborative, working environment as independent coaches, triathlon coaches. So we have, you know, journal clubs where we, you know, we learn and play, you know, challenge each other in coaching. And we can also, because we're collaborative, we're, you know, we have actually everybody's best interests at heart in terms of, you know, athletes that different coaches are working with. So that's been really rewarding as well.
So now with your coaching business, and you've kind of stepped away from the full-time racing thing, are there any athletes that you have currently that you can give a shout out to that maybe they've done something great in the last little while that you want to give them props for, or they've got something coming up that you want to give them some encouragement for?
Well, I'll take a moment to say that I'm super excited about some athletes, having some athletes in Ultramans that are coming up. I've got three athletes registered in Penticton, two at Ultraman Canada and one at the 520 for 2022. They're all going to be first time Ultraman athletes. So that will be their new adventure, just like Ultraman Canada was my first one. Nick Dean who's in Ottawa, is going to be doing the 520, and Amy Robitaille, here in Guelph, and AA Girard is also in Ottawa, are both going to be doing Ultraman Canada. AA Girard actually, just this, past weekend did her own personal 4x4x48 challenge, which, many listeners will know, is, David Goggins challenge, to run 4 miles at the top of every fourth hour for 48 hours, something he did in training for his, ultra runs. He's an Ultraman finisher as well. I think he got second in, 2006, maybe the year after I crewed, in addition to his fame in all things Ultraman was, one of the, steps along his journey as well. So she did that and we had fun just sort of planning out to how she was going to do that as a little training adventure. But yeah, I'm excited for, seeing how everyone goes next year, and vicariously living through that, that path with them.
And will you be bringing the family out to, be up?
Good question. Oh, good question. We did, go as a family to Penticton back in 2017 when they had the multi-sport world championships there. I did the aqua bike, and it was a real fun trip. It'd be great to be able to go out again. Not quite sure how that's going to play out with our summer plans, but wouldn't count it out.
And within your own discomfort zone, performance coaching, how many coaches do you have working in your program?
It's mostly myself. I have another coach. He also has a day job though, so he doesn't coach a lot of athletes. He works with our provincial governing body actually in triathlon. So, that's a really good relationship. His name is, Mike Mahoney. So he's the program manager for Triathlon Ontario. And so it's been fun working with Mike. Mike has a handful of athletes and supports camps and everything that we do. That's been really great. We work with a strength coach, who's a physiotherapist as well, here in Guelph. It's the ideal environment for, rehab and strength that I would imagine is thankfully what, Jared Lando and his wife Laura have built, at Defy Physiotherapy in Guelph. And so it's great to have our athletes be able to train and work out there and get their physio needs met there. So again, it's building the team, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what about your team at home? What does that comprise of? What's the family unit look like?
Team at home. Mike? Yeah. So I met my partner, Kate, here in Guelph, after moving here, you know, again, 2013. We she's a prof here at the University of Guelph in geography, and just, you know, most wonderful person I've ever met. And we have two boys. Owen is 5, goes to John McCrae School, as we mentioned. Mm-hmm. Aiden is 3 months old. So we got a new little package in the household these days, which comes with its own joys and challenges. Yeah, it's great. I got to tell you, you know, family challenges are way harder than Ultraman. it's so rewarding and wonderful. But they'll test you at every turn, and it's I'm just thrilled to have the life that I do and feel incredibly privileged. I think that, you know, that's something I want to add. You know, all these adventures, and you hear these stories that I'm telling, all of it is on a backbone of privilege. You know, I think it's important that we, you know, in this time and place, we acknowledge the privileges that we do have, the privilege that we do have. And, you know, it's easy to tell the tale as if there was some great overcoming or some great, I was able to do all these things against the odds. But the reality is that I've had great privilege to lean on throughout that. And so I, you know, that's always important for me to stay grounded with and remember, and give back to, with this. So, yeah. And so similarly, I've been so lucky to have, you know, to find myself with, living the life coaching and with a great family.
Mm-hmm. There was one story I wanted to jump back to. I just didn't get a chance to work it in at some point. When we were speaking about Ohana, you have a really interesting Ultraman Ohana story from when you were in Ironman Mont Tremblant. Can you share that one with us?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's funny. I think many people that are in the Ohana that might be listening to this would know what we're talking about when we say that people that everybody, even though we might not know them well, feels close in a way. I remember an athlete from 2011 that I competed with in Hawaii, and I'm not going to try and pronounce his last name, but it was Andres from Mexico. And he, for those of you that know him, larger than life character, very gregarious and fun. I was at Mont Tremblant supporting some athletes. I was coaching and cheering from the sidelines at the Ironman there. And he was in the race. And I can't remember which one of us saw the other one first, but there was a cheer and stuff. And he just like looks at me, stops in the middle of his marathon, runs over and just like pretty much picks me up in this hug. And, you know, again, I didn't really know him that well. We, you know, we cross paths in the Ultraman. Everybody's, you know, feels really close on the weekend, but, you know, in so many other environments, that's where it ends. Yeah. But there was, again, this feeling of love. There's this idea, this understanding. And there's so many people that I feel that way connected to. And, you know, when I hear stories of things that good and bad that happen, it feels like it's happening to you in a way. And you know, there's always been that, that connection, mm-hmm. to everyone in the Ohana.
And I think that's why once people get into this, they keep coming back year after year after year to race. And it's partly to be at the race, but more to just be around those people again. And yeah. whether it's the same people or new people, it's the same people.
Yes. Yeah, I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah. All right. Well, I got one last question for you. I tried to find unique things about people to ask them about, because some of this athletic stuff runs on similar veins all the time. And the conversations can sound a little similar. I understand that you dabble in mapping data sets. Can you share with us a little bit about what that is all about? And like, why is this important to you?
I'm a bit of a map junkie, if you will. And this predates, you know, internet mapping or data sets as it were. But it's just places. I think that was always something that really resonated with me with Ultraman, actually, was the fact that it was that going around the Big Island of Hawaii had so much diversity and was such a fascinating place. You know, that connection that I had with Sudbury when I was starting triathlon, it was, you feel very connected to the place that you're training and racing in. And maps to me were always this fascinating window into places that I hadn't been through, just looking at where things were in relation to each other and how things worked, you know, topographically, or, you know, watersheds and all just different things. It's funny. So I'm now, you know, with a geographer, and I'm not a geographer at all, but I'm sort of like a closet geographer, right? And so when the internet mapping came about, you know, during my triathlon time, you know, over the last 20 years, I remember the first Google map or the precursor to that, when that data was available for anyone to like click and build. I was just like, it was
building
just so
layers
wonderful. Yeah, absolutely. And it's, and so it's just a little, pet interest of mine that I enjoy. I know the latest, sort of Strava plugin that I use is something called Wanderer Earth. So this is, this group, I think it might be academics, I'm not sure who they were, in Atlanta, Georgia, who building a database of trees in the city. And so they had, you know, their data set for that, and they had their layers and made use of it, and decided that they were going to create this app that would pull your data from Strava and show you not just a heat map of, you know, like you might see on Strava, but a map of all of the unique roads that you've been on and how many you've done lately for running and, or running like anything on foot, as well as anything on a bicycle. And then there's little challenges and points and all this stuff that, again, takes you right down the rabbit hole and gets you to do silly things just to, you know, just to win some game. But it was fascinating how, for me, in my competitive training, I would do what was good for consistency. And I found myself on the same routes all the time, but I'd play with this app, and I'm now digging into maps of places that I thought was my backyard and I didn't even know it was there. Mm-hmm. And so it's like rediscovering, my own backyard, or if we're visiting some other place, I'm immediately looking to see what roads I've never seen or been on and go explore them. And so, you know, I love that because it really connects what I like to do physically and that love of maps and places, new places and things.
Is there a Pokemon Go lair for that?
Pokemon Go is not something I ever got into. One time I was out for a run and I went by these people all walking around like zombies at one point, and I didn't know what was going on back in the early Pokemon Go days. I later found out that there must have been a whatever they call them that's there. So I never quite got to that. But yeah.
Well, Mike, you know what? I really appreciate the time that you've given me today. And this is going to be a tough one to edit down to fit, because you've given me so much great information. And well, maybe I won't edit it down. We'll see what we do. But thanks a lot. Appreciate the time. And good luck with the coaching business and the little ones and getting them raised. And hopefully you find some new roads to travel down on those maps.
Well, thanks very much, Larry. I really appreciate being on and getting to share these stories. You know, they mean so much to me. It's great to share them.
Yeah. Well, you've definitely given us the idea of what the Ohana is all about today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, if you like what you heard today, please tell a friend and be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. We'd appreciate it if you'd rate and review the show while you're there. Drop the names of the people you think we should interview, and we'll get in touch with them and make that happen. Thank you for listening to 515, the Ultraman Podcast, a production of 55 Enterprises. Now really, go subscribe now before you forget.